Listen to the voices of our world.
You know, it's bad enough to have a disease that's going to take your life much sooner than it should.
This mama had no place to live, had no place to sleep.
But it's even worse, I think, if you don't have people that care about you along the way.
Welcome to Voices of Our World, a presentation of this station and Mary Knoll. I'm Eileen Bott. Traveling is not just about discovery and exploration of the unknown. It is also a time of self-reflection and an understanding of what we have in common with a stranger. Today we'll discuss housing and healthcare, two things that no one can live without. We'll fly to Kenya to see how education and collective work can make an incredible difference.
Nairobi, city of gridlock. Cars, bicycles, and people vie to be the first to arrive at their destination without the aid of traffic lights. Just to get to the Akumba bus station a block away took half an hour, and where we were going, Kitale, was 8 hours away. You couldn't call it a drive. It was more like being an ant glued onto the handle of a jackhammer. No, not that loud, but the nonstop shake ensured that my kidneys were rearranged and placed in my head. Wow! Now, out the window was a world of wonder. Lakes filled with flamingos, zebras staring, and monkeys looking like they're trying to hitch a ride. We finally arrived frazzled, feeling we needed an oxygen tank after prolonged exhaust inhalation, and there she was, our smiling savior with a 4x4, Mary Knoll Mishner, Susan Nagley. She whisked us onto a favorite restaurant where Mary Knoll's sisters Paula Kuntz and Noel Drescher sipped drinks under ceiling fans. They couldn't wait to introduce us to their favorite waiter. We ate with the same enthusiasm as meeting someone new. All three were going to open up their lives for us to record. It's dark at 6 o'clock near the equator. As Susan fiddled with her gate's lock, a man peered over the fence and showered her with niceties, as is proper in Kenya. I stood there and smiled at humans' ability to straddle time. This neighbor's guard was standing underneath a 15-foot satellite dish, armed with a bow and arrow. We entered her garden and marveled at the stars.
Is that part of the Milky Way there?
I don't think so. Yeah. I think they're just stars, and you can see them really well here because there's not so much electricity. And then the Southern Cross should be over this way.
Over Kenyan tea, Susan told us why she became a physician.
I took off a year between high school and college to work for my dad in his dental office. I developed x-rays, and so I said to Dad one day, I said, could you teach me how to read these? You know, and he was really adamant. He said, absolutely not. Only a dentist reads x-rays. And I was so taken aback because I didn't want to read the x-rays to do anything. I was bored. I wanted to learn, right? And I thought, I don't think I ever want anybody to tell me I can't learn something again. And if I was in nursing, somebody might say that to me. Mm-hmm. So that was when I started thinking about being a physician.
Susan Nagley became a Mary Knoll missioner in 1984. She spent 7 years in Tanzania, 12 years in southern Sudan, even as its civil war intensified, and then she decided to move to Kenya, where she could continue her life's passions, practicing and teaching medicine in Kitale. Kathy asked Susan why she chose to leave the comforts of life in America for life in Eastern Africa.
I would have to say that I wouldn't be that comfortable in the United States. It would be very hard to work in a place where there's a lot of litigation and a lot of pressure to see so many patients. And that's not to say that there aren't frustrations here. Of course there are. There's still a lot of room for making improvements and improving the health care that's provided to people. Mm-hmm. And not just at the level of knowing the medicine, but at the level of caring for a person, you know, mm-hmm. being kind to them, empathizing with them. I mean, that's true everywhere. It's not just here. I guess that's why it's nice to work at a small cottage hospital, because it probably is easier to make changes a little bit more quickly. And also, hopefully, we're doing it for reasons other than prestige and money. And hopefully we're doing it because we like it, first of all. And secondly, we're doing it because this is a part of the way we live what we believe in terms of faith and community and compassion and to care for other people, to treat them like that was your mother or your brother or your child.
If you think traveling is a humbling experience, then living and working in a culture that's not your own is much more difficult. Susan Nagley has mastered Kenya's national language, Kiswahili, but her patients often speak tribal languages. Here's what Susan told Kathy about being an outsider, no matter how long you've been in the region.
Even after being here for, 19 years, I have to keep reminding myself that there's probably a whole layer of their lives that we don't have a clue about. And it's certainly true even in our own culture. A lot of things that we do in healthcare, we do because maybe it's the way our families did it or our friends do it, or it's something that is the current fad. But there is a big, big level of fear and superstition, and there's a whole system of blaming and cursing in this culture that we don't have in our culture. And you really have to be aware, first of all, that it's there, and then to try and have some idea of what's going on, you have to ask questions and try and figure out what might be behind what some people are doing. I can give you a really good example from Southern Sudan. There was a man who had come to the clinic because he was sick and had been seen by the sisters, and they had treated him as an outpatient, and he went home. And then the priest, actually they may have called the priest because the man was dying, they said, and they wanted the priest to give him a blessing. And Father Tim said, well, you know, he doesn't look that sick to me, and the doctor's back, would you not bring him to the hospital? So they agreed. So they brought him. I saw him in the clinic, and I put him in the hospital. And he would had been there maybe 3 or 4 days. And I thought he had some problem with ulcers. He had no fever. He was doing well enough. We brought him to church on Sunday. We had a blessing for him and prayed for him. And on Monday morning, he was dead. It was a big shock because I couldn't understand why this guy had dropped dead on us. So I said to the family, what I really would like to do is to look in his abdomen and see if I can figure out what happened so I know maybe for the future. And they agreed. So I opened up his abdomen, and what did I find? But lots of pus. It was all on the right side of his abdomen, all the way up underneath his liver. So what I assumed had happened was that he had had a chronic appendicitis, that it had ruptured, walled off, and then he had just gradually gone down and down and down. And when I saw that, I said, given the situation that we had and the diagnostic capabilities we had, we never would have figured out this problem from the way he presented. Uh-huh. So I was satisfied. A couple months later, one of the nurses came to me and he said he had been up on the plateau and he had been hearing people talking in their own language. And the people were saying the man that died was a wizard, and what the local people did was that they'd take a stick and they would ram it up his rectum, because that's the way they got rid of wizards. And that's what they did. So that's what was behind all of this. The man had an injury that was inflicted locally because of their beliefs about who he was and what he did. That's how he got the infection in his abdomen. And nobody ever told us anything about that. So yeah, there are lots of superstitions, and there's lots of curses, and there's lots of beliefs out there. And it's a whole nother world. And, yeah. You know, unless you are aware that it's out there, first of all, you'll never have a chance of even finding out what's going on.
And maybe we all have assumptions or presumptions about what the other individual knows. And in a way, you're both speaking a totally different language because of culture.
The thing I would hope is that every time something like this happens, would remember that I still have a lot to learn. And I think all of us, every single day of our lives, have to try and look at what's happening to another individual from their perspective as much as possible to have a better understanding of what's going on.
You had an AIDS patient that you didn't know was an AIDS patient, and you lost him within 48 hours because you didn't know what was going on.
it's hard enough to lose a patient, particularly an older patient, but it's even worse when it's a younger person that has a family. And what I would hope, at least for Kenya, is that people in leadership, and especially in our own church, would start to do as much as possible to remove the shame and stigma of AIDS and help each and every one of us to treat people with compassion and dignity. Because until that happens, people are not going to get tested and find out their status. They're going to be afraid of being discovered. And a lot of them suffer for it. They're discriminated against. They can lose their house, their job, their livelihood. They can be shunned by their family and their neighbors. So, of course, it's a terrible, frightening thing. It's worse than the disease. You know, it's bad enough to have a disease it's going to take your life much sooner than it should. And you're going to suffer quite a bit in the process. But it's even worse, I think, if you don't have people that care about you along the way.
At the end of the day here, what do you take home with you? What is the satisfaction? What's the trade-off?
Well, I really like working with people. Like I said, I didn't want to be a dentist because I couldn't talk to my patients, you know. And I love medicine. I love trying to figure out what's wrong with sick people and helping them either get better or helping them to be as comfortable as possible if they can't be cured of whatever's ailing them. Compared to Sudan, there's a lot more possibility for teaching here. The level of basic education is much higher. And to me, it's not too important to say only doctors can do this and only nurses can do that, because many, many times here, you'll find a nurse in a position of having to function as a physician. And so if he or she is capable of it, why not teach them as much as they're able to learn so that when they get in that position, they can do the best job possible.
When asked what could be done to improve health care of people overall, Susan said,
well, the biggest improvements in health care, certainly in our own country, were public health initiatives. Now, in order to do that, you have to have peace. And that's a big problem on this continent and a big problem in our world. You know, there's a lot of people that still choose war and fighting as a way to solve their problems. But if you have a peacetime situation, the best way to improve the health care of any group, I think, is to implement good public health measures. Things like good prenatal care, immunizations for children, clean water, adequate nutrition, and education, particularly education of women. The more women are educated, the better they can take care of their children and the healthier their families will be. There's no question about that.
Do you see the correlation between education and improved health care? Give us an example. Log on to the Voices of Our World webpage, www.maryknoll.org/voices. There's a spot there for your feedback. I'm Eileen Bott, and you're listening to Voices of Our World. You can call us at 1-877-MARY-KNOLL. That's 1-877-MARY-KNOLL. K-N-O-L-L.